show you a better way.
Hi, folks. This is Shaq Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life. If times get tough, or even if they don't, today is February the 25th, 2015. It's Wednesday. That's hump day for some of you guys. If you're familiar with the commercial, Mike. That one. Yeah, poor camels. Anyway, before I bring our special guest on, and I'm jazzed about this today, I got Luke Callahan coming on today. This is a guy that was making a couple $1,000s a week. Growing stuff in his house. Isn't that special? Yeah, I'm in a weird mood today. Anyway, no, not that stuff. Microgreens. Microgreens. This is a guy who decided he wanted to grow things for a living and didn't have any land, and his solution was to grow microgreens. What the heck are you going to do with microgreens? Well, you sell them by the ounce, kind of like that other stuff, but you actually sell them to people at farmers markets and chefs and things like that, and it's actually a really viable business and a pretty easy way to get into a business where you're producing food. It's also a pretty good model to look at if you want to do something else. So I think Luke will have a lot of advice both on microgreens in general, for those that maybe just want to grow them for their own use because they are incredibly nutritious, for those that want to take a stab at this as a business, or for those that want to work a similar business in the production of plants and animals and things like that. Before I bring Luke on, though, let's go ahead and take care of our sponsors. They do a lot to help take care of you. Sponsor of the day, number one today, is KnifeKits.com. As America rapidly devolves into a nation of people that call a guy whenever they have a problem and no longer have a skill set, we need to do what we can to encourage skills in ourselves and in our kids. And what kid doesn't want to build a knife with dad or mom? I know I would have loved to have done that when I was a kid. And, you know, you just might learn something along the way. Doing the easy stuff with knife building, final fit and finish of your handles and sharpening and stuff like that might lead you to an entire new hobby of bladesmithing, or it just might be something cool that's inexpensive to do with your kids. Check them out today, KnifeKits.com. Remember, they do support the Member Support Brigade with a discount for you, so get your discount before you order from the good folks at KnifeKits.com. Next up today, Backwoods Home Magazine, the absolute easiest company I've ever had to endorse for anything in my life because I subscribed to them in 1994. That would be 21 years that Jack Spierko himself has been a reader and subscriber to Backwoods Home Magazine. They've been a sponsor for about three of those 21 years. That says something, doesn't it? A lot of the stuff, especially the stuff that I began this show with, the knowledge I shared directly, when I was driving in my car, yes, for those of you newer to the show, I started this show and for 2 years did it from my car. A lot of that knowledge I shared came from Backwoods Home Magazine. If you'd like to see what it looks like when you take Mother Earth news, make it more practical, and give it libertarian flair, check out Backwoods Home. I've been a subscriber for 20 plus years. Give them a shot and likely you'll become one, too. Lifelong subscriber, that is. Next up, let us look at the year that was the episode. It was 1526, because that is our date today. I have three for you. The Tyndale Bible, the Beretta Weapons Factory, a family business since 1526, and solving a cubic equations is a secret. They're all good, but I'm going to read the Tyndale Bible because I think it has the greatest lesson for us today. And trust me, when I get to the lesson part, from my take anyway, it won't have a daggone thing to do with religion or the Bible at all. Not really, anyway. With only seven printing presses in London, it's impossible to get anything controversial past the authorities. So William Tyndale takes a boat to Hamburg, Germany, and drops out of sight. Martin Luther's German translation has been filtering into England, but Tyndale thinks an English translation from the original is needed. German presses publishes translation of the New Testament, and it's a bestseller. Tyndale's translation will eventually become the authorized version as he works on the rest of the Bible, with additions from Bishop Coverdale. Tyndale is risking his life, so he's watching his steps. It will be another 9 or 10 years before they catch him, and when they do, he will be strangled to death at the stake, and then his body will be burned. Nice guys back then, huh? Anyway, my take by Alex Shrugged, who puts these together for us. Tyndale had a wicked sense of humor, but his puns won't make sense to the modern reader without context. He also has a smooth, rhythmic writing style that does not come through to the modern reader, but it made translations very easy to read. To give you a sense of his style, I've selected Matthew 29:30, but as you read it, think of what someone might do if they took it literally. Here we go. Wherefore, if thy right eye offend thee, pluck him out and cast him unto thee, cast him from thee. Better it is for thee that one thy members perish than thy whole body should be cast into hell. Also, if thy right hand offend thee, cut him off and cast him from thee. Better it is that one of thy members perish than all thy body should be cast into hell. My take by Jack Spirico is a little bit different. I don't really care at this present time who's fighting whom for what purpose. What you see here is what always happens when people begin to think for themselves and go to another level and seek liberty at a higher level. In this case, the liberty to think for yourself and interpret scripture for yourself. But it doesn't matter what it is to the people in power. If people in power have been using something to maintain power, they see anything that challenges as a threat. Not to what's right or wrong, not to what's just or unjust, but a threat to the very power structure that they have. It makes me think of an old movie, a Kevin Costner movie. Remember Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves? Right? There's a line in there that probably nobody quotes but weird people like me. And I might even not get it right. It'd be a paraphrase, but it was something to this effect. The Sheriff of Nottingham says, I will not have the entire feudal order turned on its head by one man. See, the problem wasn't, in that case, Robin Hood. The problem in this case is not the Lutheran Bible. The problem is a challenge to the authority, and all challenges to authority are met with slander and violence by those in power. To the point where they corrupt words to where they no longer mean what they're supposed to mean, and therefore you can't even have a rational conversation with someone who has a different view than you. Take, for instance, the word dun-dun-dun. Progressive. Those are evil socialists. Actually, that's what it means because we've ruined the word. Progress means to move forward. Okay? And the reality is that there is nothing progressive about socialism. There is nothing progressive about communism. They are extremely regressive systems, just as regressive as our current system of neo-fascism in this country. But whatever you can do to derail people is what you do. So you ruin a word like progressive by getting your fellow lackeys on the left to co-opt it and make it mean something that it doesn't mean. So that when people go out and say, I'm a progressive, they are saying, hey, I believe in lots of socialism. If you were progressive, what you would be for is freedom and liberty for individuals without the tyranny of a state coming down on them and preventing them from progressing to the next level of human liberty. I would like you to think about that today. Those of you that think minarchism, anarchism, etc., cannot work. The reality is people are more free today than they ever have been in the history of planet Earth. In most of the world. And we got there by progressing to different levels of liberty. And the message, the entire time, from way before the 1500s, where you would burn someone at the stake because he wrote a book a little bit differently than the book you used to control people and let people read it that you didn't think were ready to read it yet, from that point forward and from way back from there, if we allow this, it will be anarchy in the streets. There will be blood. There will be terror. It will be horrible. There will be no order. There will be no sense of control. We need this in place to keep everybody safe. It's always been the message, and the progress toward liberty has been one progression after the other of tearing from the hands of those in control that which they use to control us. We are entering a very dangerous time, though, a regressive time, where they plan on using technology to regress to greater levels of control. But make sure you figure this out, folks. the message will be the same. We have to have order. We have to have law. We have to have this. We have to have that. We are the greatest nation ever. Blah, 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 blah. The destiny of humankind lies in individual liberty and the recognition of the right to individual sovereignty of each individual, the right to be safe in their possession of their private property, to not be compelled to testify among them against themselves, to be free of unreasonable searches of their papers. And today, folks, your papers are your files. But they are electronic, changes nothing. The very core and foundation of this nation was one that was supposed to be progressive. Remember that the next time you hear the word used to define a Democrat. Democrats and Republicans, as we think of them today, are in the same spot as conservatives and liberals of the day, and socialists and communists and neo-fascists of the day. The spot we call regressivism. They just have different ways and different methodology with which to regress upon you, but what they all share in common is an aggression upon your individual liberties. Didn't know I was going to say all that today. Hope you enjoyed it. Anyway, my take by Jack Spirko. Totally different shift of gears now as I bring our special guest on, Luke Callahan, to talk about developing a business selling microgreens. What does that have to do with personal individual liberty? I believe the single greatest thing that any human being can do to create personal liberty in their own lives is to develop a successful business, whether it be with microgreens, a nursery, a conventional business, a hot dog stand. I don't care what it is, but when your actions, your direct actions result in the income stream that provides from your own needs and is independent from the decisions, choices, and attitudes of others, and all you have to serve instead of some mythical monstrosity placed above you is your own customer base whom you are free to pick from and turn down at your own will, then you have liberty. I think you will then also, it will be the only time that you will truly understand the insidious nature of the oppression of the state. But let's get off of all that. Let's have some fun. Let's bring our special guest on. And let's talk about building a business, selling plants by the ounce that you grow in your house, but not that kind of plant, the other kind, the kind you can buy outside of Colorado, Washington, and California. You can do this anywhere. And with that, it's my pleasure to introduce our special guest right now, Mr. Luke Callahan.
Hey, Jack. Thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure.
Hey, man, I have you on to talk about two things that I really dig, man. One is growing food, and the other is starting a business of your own. And in your case specifically, how to start a business in the microgreens world, which a lot of people haven't even heard of, and we'll talk about a lot today. But before, you know, we even get into the main subject, I always like to try to get my guests connected to my audience. So I'm sure when you were an eighth grader, or let's say a fourth grader, picking your nose in grade school, you weren't thinking, I'm going to grow up and grow food for people. So how did you get, let's say, the I want to produce food and the entrepreneurial bug both?
Oh, man, that's a good question. Food, yeah, I never even thought about producing food until a handful of years ago. My background's in building. I've always, since I was able enough to break things, I've had wrenches in my hands and putting motors on bicycles and just kind of tinkering in that regard. And so I kind of did that from the time I was 10 onward till today, right? But I think in that innate desire to tinker with things and figure things out is kind of a desire to understand how things work, kind of the systems of things, especially like an internal combustion engine. If it doesn't run, you know, it's because it's not getting fuel, or it's not getting air or compression or spark, right? I mean, it's very simple to figure out. And so you can kind of start deducing how things work and then really, you know, be able to solve them. And so, you know, that led to kind of an undergraduate degree in construction management. And then I was working for a construction company they offered the lead, like a $1,000 bonus if I took the lead exam, which is the lead accredited professionals. It's like the green building certification. So I crammed for a weekend and passed it. And then, so I got the bonus. And in doing that, I was like, man, this sustainability stuff is pretty cool. And so then I actually, a friend of mine told me that there was a free Masters of Sustainability going on in Sweden. I applied for it. I ended up getting into it. I went and did that. And then that's when I really started to understand what was going on with our food system and just how big of an issue this is. And if you look forward, like kind of one of the biggest growth sectors, no pun intended, coming forward. So once I started understanding how kind of effed our whole food system was, that's when I really started to want to get in there and say, okay, like how can I make an impact in this? How can I help others do the same? And then I started learning about food. And then, not to go on, but then Curtis Stone and I had become friends while I was doing that program in Sweden. I had interviewed him for a podcast I was doing. It was under Grow Action. I don't do that podcast any longer, but basically he and I developed the idea to do a step-by-step course where if he could teach, cause he's the successful urban farmer. He grows food on people's front yards. I think he's got 7 different plots, earns about $80,000 a year selling primarily to restaurants and farmers markets. So the whole premise was that if he could teach me to start an urban farm, then we could teach you. We created this course step-by-step. You know, week by week, I was supposed to week one, get land, week two, get crops in the land. And week one came around. I didn't have land. I thought I did, and it fell through at the last minute. He introduced me to the idea of microgreens, and I had no idea what they were. And then it just kind of took off from there.
So can you kind of start out with just explaining to people what is a microgreen? When do we go from micro to macro? I mean, you know, what exactly makes something a microgreen, and why is there value in them? What do people value about them?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I first started, I had absolutely no idea what they were. I like to introduce people to them as the idea of the veal of vegetables, right? They're the youngest, most tender crops that you can grow and eat. Basically what they are is a common one is sunflowers. So you plant your sunflower and 10 days later, so it sprouts, you plant it in soil, it sprouts. 10 days later, it comes up as basically this little plant with 2 big leaves. They're called the cotyledons. And at that point it's edible. It's about 3 inches tall and it's really tender. And what it does is it makes for a great garnish on restaurant plates, but it also is great base for a salad. So it's got all these different applications. And because it's so easy to grow and you can grow them in such abundance, you can really do a lot with them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So can you talk about, you know, how do you actually do this? So how do I actually set up to grow at a level beyond filling my own salad plate?
Yeah, you bet. I mean, the basics are the same, right? If you're just growing for your own personal use, what you're going to do is you're going to get a simple germination tray. They're called 10-20s in the nursery world. It's basically 10 inches by 20 inches, and it's just a plastic tray, 1 inch deep. You fill it with soil. You water the soil a bit, you compress it, and then you just broadcast seeds onto it. And what you do then is you water the seeds, leave them covered with a paper towel for 3 days. They start to sprout. As soon as they start to sprout, you take the paper towel off. Again, you're watering them every day, and then you put them under either natural light or fluorescent light. And you can use fluorescent lights because they'll provide the vegetative light needed in the vegetative growth cycle. So basically the right wavelengths. If you were going to have flowering plants, you'd want like kind of the full on grow lights. But just to get started, you can use shop lights. I recommend people use T8s or T5 fluorescent lights. So then you stick them under, you stick that tray under your light for about 7 days and you can have the lights on 16, 18 hours a day, put them on a timer so they automatically turn on and off at the same time. And then 7 days later, they're ready to harvest. So they're about 3 inches tall, so you harvest them. You cut them off right at the base, and then you put them into you put them into your salad bowl and you can eat them. Or if you're going to do this as a business and you want to deliver it, you do that tray, but you do, say, 10 trays. Or, you know, at my peak, I was doing 100 trays at once.
Wow. And so you were doing 100 trays, just so people can get an idea of the spatial requirements. How much area were you using to do that in?
Well, to give you a sense of things, I started out by growing in my basement, and my max capacity there was like, I hit 100 trays there, and then I ended up acquiring a shipping container, and I built that out to be a whole grow setup, and then we built a greenhouse off the south face of it. So, you know, what is a shipping container? It's 36 feet really by 8 feet, so, you know, less than 300 square feet, about 300 square feet. I mean, it really doesn't take much, because what you do is you verticalize. Since you put the trays under lights and they want to be within about a foot of the light, that means that you can have about 5 shelves high of lights and trays. So each light and tray setup takes about 18 inches, and then you can stack, and actually a little bit less, say 14 inches. So you can easily get 5 levels high in there, in the shipping container or in your basement or your spare room. The thing to remember when you're growing them, though, is that these microgreens, they like to be in conditions just like you do, or just like your child does, like basically 70 degrees, fairly low relative humidity. I mean, basically think of it like creating the environment of raising a kid.
So it clearly lends itself to indoor production. I would bet most anybody doing it commercially is doing that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So if you get things set up right and you start cranking these things out, you know, my understanding is they have some shelf life, but this is, you know, the whole fact that you're selling them so young means that they need to be moved. So I'm going to do this. I'm going to set up a business. It would seem that the initial production, I'll probably screw some things up, but yeah, I'll get that right. I'll get to the point where I can produce these things. The challenge will actually be then finding your first customer. So could you take us through the process of getting your first customer for your business?
Yeah, absolutely. So again, the customers for these products, these microgreens, are primarily restaurants and then farmers market consumers. So restaurants are the best customers. And, you know, when I started, I was terrified of going into a restaurant kitchen and selling something. I mean, one, I didn't have a lot of experience selling anything. Two, I, you know, still kind of didn't really know what microgreens were. After all, I was trying to sell it within 3 weeks of, you know, discovering what microgreens were. And then beyond that, it's the whole understanding what chefs are like and what the restaurant scene is like. So, you know, the basics of it is you want to say, okay, I'm going to try and sell to restaurants, and you've got your product in a package, and you've got a fresh sheet, which is just basically a menu of things that the chef can order from you. Think of it like a product menu. And then you've got your business card. So you've got your business card, your fresh sheet, and a product sample. And your goal is to go introduce yourself and this product to the chef. So what you do is you call beforehand, and you say, you know, it'll usually be a gal up front. And you say, hey, can I talk to Chef Tony, or can you tell Chef Tony that I'm going to come by and drop by a sample? And you're not trying to get a hold of the chef. You're just trying to get it so he knows you're going to come by. Because some of these chefs have huge egos, and, you know, they'll yell you out of their kitchen. Like, that's certainly happened to me before. It's not a big deal. And that was before I kind of knew the system of how to get in, talk to the chef, and on the right terms. The key to going in and selling to getting new restaurant customers, new chef customers, is to go in at the right time. And the right time is kind of across the board. It's going to be Tuesday through Thursday between 2 and 4 o'clock. And what that is that's after the lunch rush, and it's before dinner preparation. So,
and it's a slow day to begin with, right? I mean,
Tuesday through Thursday.
I've taken early dinners there, and it's me, my wife, and some old couple, right? I mean, that's the time of day that it's like that.
That's exactly right. And, you know, as you get to know the chefs more and build rapport with them, you'll be able to go in at other times. But your goal is, step number one, don't piss off the chef. I mean, sure. Your goal is to build a nice relationship with them, and they want to know that you understand the restaurant industry enough to say, hey, this is the time when they're less busy, and
You're looking for the Bobby Flay attitude, not the Gordon Ramsay attitude when your first contact, right?
That's right. A little bit of finesse goes a long way.
Okay, so we've made first contact. You just basically bring them a sample when you do that. Have you maybe checked out their menu so you're bringing them something that's going to fit into what they're doing? Do you just bring them kind of like a little bit of everything you're doing or some of your best stuff? I mean, how is that presented? Do you bring it just in a clamshell? I mean, do you bring them enough to play with or just enough to get like a single, you know, component to get an idea of what you're doing?
Yeah, great questions. I mean, there's a lot there. You know, first you want to understand who the restaurant is, who the chef is, and what they would value in your microgreens, right? So a lot of times it's adding presentation quality to their plates. So these microgreens are really different, beautiful colors, like bright reds, bright greens, purples. And so a lot of times the chefs will use them to plate up add a ton of value to their plates. So if your chef is looking for that, and chances are they are, you want to bring them some really beautiful different microgreens. You want to bring them some chard. You want to bring them some sunflower shoots. You want to bring them your radish mix, which is triton and daikon and a handful of other types. And so the basically like pinks, purples, and reds. And you want to bring them to the restaurant in a clamshell, exactly how you would deliver it normally. And your goal then is just to give them the sample. What they'll do is they'll open up the clamshell, they'll see it, that it's beautiful, and then they'll taste it and they'll say, oh, and you know, it tastes great. And so then your goal is just to start the conversation with them and say, hey, do you use microgreens already? If so, what do you use? If you do, where do you get it from? What are you paying for it? And your goal with the first interaction with the chef is really, at the end of the day, just to build a relationship with them. This is, if you imagine your business out 2, 4, 5 years from now, you're going to know this chef really well. And your goal is just to say, hey, you know, I'm Luke and I'm here and I want to be buds with you. And so when you leave that interaction, your goal is really to get their phone number and be on a text relationship basis with them, because the little secret about this all is that chefs do the majority of their correspondence through text. Mm. And it's not something I've told you.
Now that's interesting right there. That's one of the little secrets you tuned in to hear today, because I didn't know that.
Yeah. And I didn't know that either getting started, right? And then once I figured that out, and it's like, because you can't get a hold of these guys by email. They're just so busy. Some guys you can, but really, not much. But they've got their phone in their pocket all day long, and they're texting.
It would make sense when you think about it, because they don't really have time for a conversation, right, with someone that wants to say, hey, how you doing? I have freaking my sous chef off today, and I shut up, right? But they need to get business done, and text is very to the freaking point. Right.
Yeah, it's not that their sous chef is off. It's that their sous chef was on a bender and he's in jail right now and he's got to get somebody to cover for him.
yeah, or he showed up but he's hung over, right?
Yeah. Oh, man. If you get into selling to chefs or just looking for light reading, check out Anthony Bourdain's Kitchen Confidential. I read that when I first got started, and it illuminated the whole restaurant industry, basically breaking it down that chefs are just a bunch of pirates, and the sous chef and the people who work for them are the crew on the ship, to the point where, you know, a new chef, like a new restaurant opens up, a chef gets pulled from a different restaurant, and then pretty soon he's on the phone trying to see which guys that he's worked with from other restaurants he can get onto his crew now. They'll jump ship, abandon their deal, and come work for their new captain. I mean, it's a funny industry and endlessly entertaining if you like good stories.
Okay, so you've made that first contact. You've got that text message going. Are there any particular restaurants that you should just like not bother with? I mean, I would think franchises are not the place to go. I can't see me forming this relationship with Chili's. It's a preset menu. There's no real, I don't think, autonomy in decision making. But, you know, are there certain restaurants that are, I mean, I guess some of the stuff really would fit in well with the sushi chefs and what have you.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, exactly. Franchises, anybody who are selling dinner plates for less than $10, $12 a plate, probably not a good bet. With that said, there's a caveat. Anybody who's doing like high quality burgers,
yeah,
bring them the sunflower shoots and get them to try them on their burgers and then they love them. So my general rule of thumb is, you know what? It only takes 10 minutes to talk to somebody. Do it. Like, you'll learn what they value in it, but after a while you'll get a trend of who likes what and then you can figure it out from there. But in my opinion, you know, half of this in going and getting new clients is just about facing your fears of rejection. So the more you can have people say no to you and be fine with it, the better off you are.
Well, when you're offering somebody a clamshell full of vegetables, I think that you have to like take into account what you're being told no to. So like if you came over to my house, Luke, and I said, would you like a beer? And you said no. I'm not going to run and bury my face in the sink and pour cold water on my face and cry. I'm really not going to care. You didn't want a beer. And I think that's kind of with this type of thing. That's how you have to look at it. I've offered you some vegetables. You didn't want them. Okay, fine. I'll go offer them to somebody else who might value them.
Exactly. I mean, what you're doing is you're just finding a fit. And I think a lot of people, when they're getting started out, they kind of get this complex like, oh, if they don't want to buy my microgreens, it's because they don't like Luke. You know, they're all bent out of shape and like, should I be doing this business? Am I a failure in life? And I mean, that's an exaggeration, but it does hit at a point of people being wrapped up in the outcome of things. And
yeah.
I mean, it's releasing it, release the outcome and just see if it's a fit.
Can we talk about maybe some of the economics of this, like the getting the production model up? Like, you know, what does it cost? What are your biggest expenses and what's the daily routine like on the growing side?
Yeah. Yeah, you bet. Where do you want to start?
I don't know. I mean, like, so I need trays. I need soil. I need some sort of irrigation. So I need lighting, most likely. I'm not going to have a perfect window angle where I can do this all with sun. So what is kind of the economic breakdown of just getting enough production to start? Because I think you'd scale into this, right? You're not going to go to the 100 tray model you had on day one and then have a whole shitload of product at the end of it and go, uh-oh. What do I do? All right. So you also would have, like, we've learned with our duck business that, like, if you're producing a dozen eggs a day, a business it makes not, right? We kind of got it backwards and went chickens first. So we had to retool and get our production level up to a sufficient quantity where when somebody came back a week later and wanted another four dozen, we could go, here you go, thanks for your money. So kind of to get into at least enough production to be taken seriously. And when a guy says, yeah, you know, I'll take 6 ounces of this, 8 ounces of that, and 14 ounces of this twice a week, you can actually deliver.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And I think, you know, I think there's kind of two stages of looking at starting any business, any production-based business, certainly. One is just test the market, right? So you're maybe experimenting with a tray or two, kind of figuring out how it works, getting enough product that you can put in a clamshell and shop it around to 5 or 10 or 20 different places. And just gauge demand, get a sense of how much, if you were in production, how much people would buy.
Okay.
And then, you know, once you say, okay, I've quote unquote validated this business model, validated the demand for my product, I'm going to now, you know, set up the infrastructure to be able to meet that demand and maybe invest $1,000 or depending on the business, maybe $10,000 and get started. You know, with this, if you put in $1,000 or $2,000, you can really create some great infrastructure to get going. So initially, if you just wanted to gauge the demand, I mean, all you need is you need a tray. You need, say, 5 trays. some soil. You don't want to buy the pot, sterilized potting soil. You need the soil, then you need the seeds, and then you need the light.
So you don't want to buy the sterilized potting soil. So what do I want to buy?
You know, I recommend just getting started. Just buy like Fox Farms organic.
Okay.
It's great stuff, and the reason
so when you're saying you don't want to sterilize, what you're saying is you don't want generic cheap ass soil. You want good quality organic soil, potting soil. But it is a potting soil mix, right?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I think the side note about sterilized soil is just that because they sterilize it, there's no life in the soil,
sure.
and so when you water it, it becomes hydrophobic, like it doesn't accept water, and the water just pools up on top.
Yep.
And it doesn't soak in. What you're really looking for is healthy soil with live organic matter in it, so that when you water it, it's kind of like chocolate cake. It becomes moist. Mm. So to the point where you like press your finger into it, and it's kind of like a sponge feel to it. That's the basic gist of it. You want live organic matter in the soil. And I wanted to touch on the seeds. The seeds economically are your biggest input expense. Absolutely one of the biggest expenses in the whole operation. So most everything else is fixed. Like you buy your trays, you're going to use those every week. You buy your lights, you buy your shelving, you buy your clamshells. Those are direct costs because you buy them, you know, directly related to your production. But your seeds are your biggest expense. And the common source is Mountain Valley Seeds. It's mvseeds.com. Honestly, Jack, between you and I would like to see somebody come into this space and create like a microgreen seed business, because I get so many questions about high quality microgreen seed sources, and I'm at a loss of where to point people to. You know, I had a great relationship with a fella who lived in the Willamette Valley about 2 hours south of Portland, Oregon, and he just kind of sold them to me casually on the side, because he's basically, they were just all cash sales of the seeds, because he does to illuminate what kind of sales this other guy does. He basically sells 50 shipping containers full of seeds out of the country every year. So when I come and buy 600 pounds of seeds, it's like a drop in the bucket.
Mm. Yeah, and I don't know what a good price is in this market. It's not something I've dabbled in. You know, I know that like one of our partners, High Mowing, sells microgreen seeds. But when you start talking about buying hundreds of pounds a year, I don't know that that scale to a discount works out. You know, I don't know that that's kind of the thing they're doing. And I think Peaceful Valley does it as well. But, it's probably something with a tremendous opportunity. The thing is, it would be a totally different model, right, than what the end customer wanted the seeds for, because now you have to grow to fruition and to seed, and some of this stuff is biannuals, and it seems like it is it's maybe somewhat daunting. Like you to believe there's enough business there, there has to be more people on the street actually making this product.
Yeah, absolutely. And the way all these seed brokers do it, you know, they're basically seed brokers, right? They don't grow the seed themselves. They contract it out to have it grown. The seed industry itself is a really fascinating discussion, and something we could get into at a later time. But yeah, you know, I don't, it's that somebody producing microgreen seeds or being a broker for them, that's a much, much more capital intensive business. I'm just trying to illuminate the fact that that's probably one of the biggest challenges in this whole business, is getting a great supply of seeds. Mountain Valley Seeds is kind of the standard, and you know, I made it work with them for a long time. But as you get going with any production business, your goal is to bring in more revenue, get more customers, and then find ways to, you know, find cheaper supplies, cheaper sources for your supply.
Okay, cool. You know, and one of the things I was thinking about while you were talking about getting started, this business has an advantage that's not present in a lot of businesses. So if you look at like our duck business, so we had this group of ducks. We figured, okay, we're going to sell chicken eggs, and we're competing with everybody and their mother. We throw up an ad for duck eggs, and all of a sudden people are showing up left and right for them. And, you know, we're meeting nowhere near what we have in demand. And then I think, okay, we need more ducks. So I order ducks, and it's like 22 to 24 weeks before eggs come out of the duck butt,
right? And I got all this time and all this opportunity I'm losing in the interim. But with your business model, if I find a lot of opportunity, I can scale in 2 to 3 weeks and be delivering what those guys want, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
that's the crazy part.
Well, that's it, right? Like, that's literally how I got started. Is that, you know, I grew my first crop. It looked like crap. And then I kind of tweaked things where I grew another crop and it was actually good, right? And so I harvested that crop, and that was about 20 days after even knowing what microgreens were. So now I had a crop I could take to the restaurant, and that day I got my first order, and he ordered 5 pounds of it, and I had 5 trays at that point. I was nowhere near capacity.
And what does a tray produce on average? I know it changes by the
you know, a tray does produce about a pound of sunflower and radish and peas. Those sunflower, radish, peas, you should get about a pound a tray.
Okay.
But, you know, I was like, okay, well, this one customer needs 5 pounds in 2 weeks, and I'm going to get more customers. So I instantly built out this basically bunk bed structure, this shelving unit where I could produce about 60 pounds. And then because I was saving money on, you know, scaling up, I built the thing just out of the 2x4s, 2x6s. But the biggest expense is light. So I just waited to wire up like 3 different, I only wired up 2 shelves to start with my lights. And then as I got more customers, I added more lights to the shelving unit, but that was it, right? Like I got the customer and I'm like, oh, I better get home and, you know, build out my infrastructure to grow more. And just in a matter of 2 weeks, you have it up and running.
Well, and by that point, even by growing, you know, you maybe went through 2 crops to get it right. Somebody else might go through 3 or 4, but they can do that at a very small scale. And once you know how to do it, you just do more.
That's it.
You figured out what works for you. So,
yeah, I mean, I really think of these microgreens as quote unquote like the gateway crop to grow heavier vegetables. I mean, you know, you get into it. I'd never grown anything before. And, you know, like with any business, the hardest thing is finding and building the relationships with your customer. That first sale is the hardest sale to get. And then once you've got that relationship, pretty soon you're thinking, hey, what else can I offer this customer? How else can I help them out? And so microgreens are really a great addition to like an urban farm where you're saying, hey, why don't I give you 10 pounds of arugula every week? Why don't I give you the kale you're looking for, the patty pan squash you're looking for, you know? And I mean, that the real advantage of the microgreens is you're up and running in no time at all and doing the things that really matter, like building relationships with your customers.
But can you make any money at this? I mean, you know, this is a bunch of sprouts, right? Some of this stuff actually sells for like enough money that you would think of it almost analogous to something else that you might sell by the ounce that you've sold, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, again, why it's the gateway crop. But oftentimes you're selling it for, I mean, the standard's $50 a pound. So $3 an ounce, you know, $48
a
pound.
Okay, so let's think about that. So $50 a pound, and this is for probably the stuff that's more conventional, because I know like the sushi and stuff, that sells like crazy high. But $50 a pound, if a tray can produce a pound, that's $50 a tray. And what's the square footage of a tray? How big is one of these trays?
Well, you could say it's 1 foot by 2 feet, so 2 square feet.
2 square feet, $50 per 2 square feet, and then that's crazy. But then that's every 2 weeks.
That's right.
So what's the annualized production value there? You're looking at 50 times what, 25?
Yep.
Right? So you're looking at $1,250 per tray per year. Annualized production out of this thing that's sort of like hydroponics with dirt.
Yeah. I mean, just so simple. So simple. Huh. The thing, though, right, in doing all these calculations is, you know, economic, like, production-wise, it's easy. The big challenge with this business is the demand. I mean, you gotta have a great market for it. You gotta get out and hustle. You gotta get out and build relationships with your chefs. I think, you know, when we do this math, it makes it sound really easy, and it is. It's a great way to get started, but it's gotta have the right conditions. And
think of the market. The local market has a lot to do with this, right? Because like you were in Portland. Yeah, like, so you go to downtown Portland, pick up a rocket, throw it, it probably goes through the window of a small restaurant, right?
Yeah.
It's just, it's that dense, and you were delivering a lot of the stuff like on a bike.
Yeah.
If you come here, I'll bet you there's enough family-run, unique boutique restaurants in a 6.2 million person metroplex like Dallas-Fort Worth. And there's a lot of it that's centralized around Fort Worth or downtown Dallas. It's there. But it's nowhere near the number, and it's nowhere near the density. So if you try to do it on a bicycle around here, you're probably going to get run over by a semi-truck. So you're going to have to take a different model. Now, when I lived in Hot Springs, Arkansas, unless you're putting it in dry ice and shipping it like some of the other competitors do, I think you're screwed. There's just not, you know, it took forever to find one really good restaurant in Hot Springs, and sadly, it was an Olive Garden, right? So like that would not be the place for this particular business with a chef model. There's a farmer's market there, but I think that from listening to you before, that was a good piece of business, but it wasn't the high dollar repeatable component to the business.
Yeah, the farmer's market's a great model. It's kind of the bread and butter. It's, you know, you've got extra crops that didn't sell to restaurants, and then you've got your basics that you always bring to the farmer's market, and it's just a good outlet. It's, you're present in the community. And, you know, you can look to earn about, you should be earning more than $200 each time. I know some people who do, all the way up to like $800 a market. And so, yeah, for a while I was like, oh, well, I'm just going to scale up this farmer's market model. And so, you know, I think my second season we had 7 farmer's markets, and anybody who sold at a farmer's market knows that that's just brutal in terms of how much work it takes to go to a farmer's market. So we found the 3 most profitable markets, and I had employees running it at each one. It's a model you can do if there's a great, if there's 1 to 2 to 3 different farmer's markets in your area. And I definitely recommend everybody who's getting started sell to the farmer's market too. If not only just to interact directly with customers, I mean, it's a great experience in of itself.
Well, it would seem like a great opportunity for what I call the detective side of marketing too. Well, so like if I have some foodie come up to me that's going to pay me, you know, whatever, $50 a pound, and they're probably not going to buy a pound, but the equivalent of $50 a pound for a bunch of sprouts and a clam shell, this is probably a person that doesn't eat Whoppers and Ding Dongs, right? This is probably a person that I can say, like, what's your favorite restaurant? And they're going to tell me about maybe a place I haven't found. And they might even, if they're a regular, they might even know, like, who the chef is there by name. And, you know, do you think you'd be interested in that, this, and what have you? So it seems like an opportunity for that as well to find other markets. And I would bet, at least in places that are foodie-centric like Portland or Austin or L.A., that a lot of times chefs, when they actually have some time off, go shop these places to find sources as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's often where you'll meet a lot of chefs that you haven't gone directly to their restaurant already. They come straight to the farmer's market to find their produce. So, yeah, I mean, it is great detective work on really understanding your customer, your end customer at the farmer's market, and the patrons of the restaurants that you're selling to.
And, you know, so when you look at this market, who are you generally competing with? I would reckon there's probably not a tremendous number of people out actually hustling and doing this right now. Where do the chefs that are using this product tend to get their product? So what's the competitive landscape look like?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the big advantages of growing microgreens locally, because the kind of industry standard is, like you touched on earlier, to order it from across the country. There's a big outfit in San Diego, and they'll package it up in dry ice and overnight ship it to you. So these guys are paying exorbitant shipping rates to get these microgreens fresh. So if you can come in and supply from a guy halfway across the country, then you're already already have an advantage. Now, sometimes you'll go to a market and discover that maybe somebody 3 hours away is already supplying this restaurant, which was the case for me. Or you could have direct competitors, you know, within 10 miles of you, which also I experienced as well. So, you know, it runs the gamut. You just got to go and talk to the chefs and see if they're already getting them and where they're getting them from.
Well, and what can you do that the other person can't, right? You get the foot in the door for the first order, and then win the business on quality. To me, I would happily compete with the dry ice guy, because there's no relationship to compete with there. And this sounds like, from listening to you, that over time this becomes a relationship business. That Chef Tony or Chef Frank or Chef Mary or whatever knows you and values you as a supplier.
And just because this guy can beat my price by a couple bucks an ounce, you know, shipping this product in a dry ice packaging doesn't really help them to take the business back from me. And it also doesn't let the chef sell what's very hot right now, locally produced. And if you think about this, with the right little bit of spin, a chef that included some microgreens with every meal, which there's really no way not to be able to do that, would be able to say there's something locally grown on every plate. And that's compelling right now. That's a, you know, maybe it's a little, what do you call it, stacking the deck, but it would be truthful.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, what you're giving them is a story to their customer that the customers are just begging for. And then at the end of the day, you're giving really high quality produce one way to differentiate yourself from your competition that I've experienced is just having better tasting microgreens. The chefs at Japanese restaurants often, like you said before, really love shiso. And I know the seed where you get the seeds for shiso, there's only a handful of them. And basically, I knew for a fact that me and the other competitor had the same seeds. And what it came down to is the chefs told me that mine tasted far superior. And I can only attribute that to the quality of the soil I was using. So again, if you're growing with really high quality soil, you have a really high quality product. At the end of the day, that trumps.
Yeah. Yeah, the taste, the flavor, the relationship, I guess all of it goes together. It also always amazes me when I listen to anybody out of the food production, ranching, permaculture world that's actually not talked about a business but done it and been successful. Even if they don't use the same terms, they use the same concepts that I used to sit in boardrooms and talk about. One with you would be ARPU, which is average revenue per unit. So now you probably know exactly where I'm going. I was listening to another interview with you, and you were talking about you increased your revenue, and the only thing you did was increase the portion size that you sold as a base portion. So can you kind of talk about how that works?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was my first the first day at the farmer's market. I was the pricing method I was using was one package for $3 and two packages for $5. And it was selling like crazy. I mean, I had people lined up at the stall all day, and I was like, man, I'm going to make so much money today. And I came home and I counted my money, and I think I had made like, oh, I don't know, maybe $300. And I was just kind of floored, and I was thinking like, geez, what went wrong? Like, what, you know, people were at my stall all day. I sold out. Like, what's the problem here? And then I started thinking about, man, I also worked hard for each transaction that I got. And at the end of the day, if somebody wanted to buy a lot, it meant that they were going to do the 2 for $5 deal. So you know, my big win was somebody giving me $5. And so real quickly, next week, I decided to just change that and double my pricing. I kept the exact same price per ounce, so basically doubled, like you said, doubled the amount in each package. And I said one package is $5 and two packages is $9. So you give people a break if they, you know, order more. And that next week I earned like $650.
Huh.
Right? And so just,
and it's because the person that's going to drop that kind of money on a microgreen isn't going to be turned off by a few dollars.
Well, you know what it is? Is it's like they don't even, you don't even know. It's like, this is the price.
Yeah.
And it's like, do you want it or do you not want it? Not like, this is the price.
Your minimum order on a farmer's market table at like $30, just to be ridiculous. People will be like, oh, I got to think about that. But when it's, you know, $6, $9, whatever, if I'm going to be at a farmer's market buying that kind of produce anyway, the price is low enough that I'm not thinking about whether or not I can afford a six pack of beer at the end of the week.
Yeah. I think a general rule of thumb for farmers market is that anything less than $5, people don't blink at.
Yeah.
Anything at $5, they start to, you know, I definitely turn some people away because it's $5.
Yeah.
But I mean, man, not $5. You just pay, you go to the farmers market, you're paying out $5 all day long.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if I'm at a farmer's market and I look at something and a guy wants, let's say, $350 for it, if I'm not buying it, it's not about the numbers. I don't want it. You know, exactly. I've had the people yelling at you like the Korean guy with the tomatoes. You buy! Well, no, I have 400 billion of those things in my backyard. So yeah. It doesn't matter where you price that for me, right? But if I'm walking down through and I see like some rare heirloom tomato I've never seen before, I might buy that just so I can take it home, crack it open, get the seeds out of the daggone thing, to be honest with you. But I'm not thinking much in that $5 price range. You get up, you know, 10, 15 bucks. I'm really starting to decide, because now I'm starting to look at my total budget for my whole trip to the farmer's market, how this is going to affect me being able to buy something at the next stand or what have you.
Yep, that's it. Exactly.
Do you get a lot of repeat business in that environment? Or?
Oh, yeah.
Really? That's great. Because I've never lived where there's a really good, thriving farmer's market community. You know, the Hot Springs one was, and the only guy that I was a repeat customer to was a guy that sold pastured poultry. Because he had something nobody else did, but everybody else was selling tomatoes and peppers. And it was like, so I would imagine that's another thing too, right? So if everybody's there, tomatoes, peppers, carrots, celery, onions, and you've got this microgreen thing, there's probably not as many people that also, you know, also ran, so to speak, there.
That is having a farmer's market where there's a good community of market goers is huge, because not only is it good revenue and good for the business, but it's just fun. I mean, it's kind of my favorite place on the planet. Everybody's out on their best behavior, and it's kind of it's the social gathering. And so being there as a producer is a pretty neat thing, where everybody's like, oh, Luke, like, what's going on? How's the week going? And to be honest, it's the thing I miss the most about not doing the microgreens anymore. And beyond that, one thing that I think very few vendors themselves take advantage of is, after the market's over, you're going to have some extra produce. And the best thing to do is not to go home and just compost it, or, you know, eat it yourself, because you'll get sick of it, but to actually just shop it around, take a big basket full of your extra produce and go to every vendor that you want something from, or every vendor, and basically trade them. And the way to do it is not to go and offer a trade, not to go say, hey, can I have some bread and I'll trade you some microgreens?
Sure.
The way to do it is to go gift. You just go out there and say, hey, I got some extra microgreens. Do you like these? Have you tried them? Just like you're selling them to a customer, have them sample them, give them to them, put them in their hands. And then there's kind of like this unspoken law of like reciprocity, where somebody's going to want to give something back to you. And if they don't give, that's totally fine too.
That's cool. But you think you're probably going to have a lot of people do it, because I know whenever I've done like trade shows and stuff like that, I always have some stuff that like I would have preferred to sell it, but I don't want to take it home. You know? And if the other thing, I'm like giving it away, and you don't want to do that. It's one thing if you're doing a trade show in Atlanta to kind of give away stuff at the last hour, because you're not hurting your repeat business. But if you do that at farmer's market, now you're setting the expectation that all I got to do is go hit this guy up like an hour before close, and you know, you don't want to do that. But trading with other vendors, you're capitalizing on that whole human nature of, I just don't want to take all this crap home, especially if it doesn't have a long shelf life. If it's a wooden sign that I handcraft in my wood shop, I'll take it home because it's not going anywhere. But tomatoes, peppers, you know, stone fruits or something like that, I don't want to feed them to the chickens. I'd rather exchange them with you.
Exactly. And that's, I mean, having the relationships with other vendors is huge, because, you know, somebody will come by and see you tired and bring you a cup of coffee that they've got from their place. You know, it's just like, it's a cool community of folks.
Yeah, definitely. And there's probably potential for referral there too, when somebody says, hey, I was looking for, and oh, the best guy here to get that from is the guy down there, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
You're making me wish we had better farmers markets here. And unfortunately, as crazy as it is, people think Texas is such a free state, and in a lot of ways we are, but it's regulation that actually holds them back here. And it's
really, what's the deal?
Nonsense. There's so much that has to be done to establish a farmer's market, and there's so many boxes that have to be ticked. And it's not the whole state, really. It's Dallas. The city of Dallas is just, it makes it like, it's not it's not worth the organizer's time to go through all this crap and then try to, because you have to start somewhere. So you have to bring, you're usually in a front end losing proposition. You have to build it over time. And anything that makes that harder just makes it, you know, less likely. We call it the hippie paper, the Dallas Observer, mm-hmm. which is for free in every, you know, supermarket in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, given away a weekly. And they had an article recently, and that's what it was. It was like, we have the worst regulations for farmers markets in the city of Dallas and all of basically Dallas County of any place in the, and we're one of the worst in the country. And I'm like, well, that makes sense. And So that makes a person, let's say, in Tarrant County that could set one up, but doesn't really understand that, that just goes, well, if there's nobody successful in a much larger market, because Dallas is a bigger market than Fort Worth, then maybe it's not worth doing here. You know, so it's like, and then you get the satellite communities doing it. And I don't know, I've never thought farmers markets work that great in rural communities because people are doing much of what they want for themselves. Like, it's very much an urban thing that, like, you know, a person with a small backyard garden just can't grow everything. And they put in that little, like you call the microgreens, like a gateway business. Well, like the gateway drug is gardening. So I start gardening and I grow cucumbers and tomatoes, so I'm blue in the face, but I start wanting to put more of that good quality stuff on my plate. I've only got so much time. I've only got so much space. You know, if I got 40 acres, I don't care. I can put in 100 trees. But for the suburbanite, the farmer's market becomes that access point to the food that they don't have time, space, or resources or knowledge to do for themselves.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Well, it'd be cool to see, I mean, my whole, and I think yours too, is just less regulation, man. That we've got too much concentration of power in our government systems all the way to the top. And you can see, I mean, that's one of the biggest problems right there is even if it wasn't a good idea, like let people pop up and see if there's demand for it instead of squashing it from the beginning.
Well, and let's stop worrying about, like, somebody's going to get food poisoning from a local producer because it just doesn't happen. It just really doesn't. It's the industrialized food system that causes all this. So what happens is they start trying to apply regulations that are meant and probably necessary for the person that's measuring their production in metric tons to the person that's measuring their production in pounds. And those two worlds are so different, you can't apply the regulation of one to the other and not destroy it, which sometimes you wonder if that's what they really want to do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you can go deep into that conspiracy there. I mean, but it's honestly, I mean, it creates this big barrier for entry. If we have legislation which makes us bent on being consumers rather than producers, it definitely helps the industrial model.
This also seems like something that, like, it'd be a great business, but it also seems for the person that, you know, if the person is sitting in Hot Springs, Arkansas, listening to this right now and goes, well, Jack just crafted my idea. I'm not saying you couldn't do it. I'm just saying I don't, like, I can name 10 restaurants off the top of my head in Fort Worth that I'm a patron of over, you know, over a couple of years that if I were doing this, I would go there first, right? I mean, I'd go down and I'd see Chef Tim Love at Lonesome Dove as quickly as I could get an audience. And he's probably not the chef at that location. That's his restaurant, though. I would get something in that person's hand. You go in there, four people, you're dropping $400 on a table. This is a natural fit for them. Hot Springs, I can't think of one restaurant that I would go to, and I lived there for 2 years, and think that I'm likely to get somewhere, maybe one, and it's not that great a place. So that person, though, this might still be a good thing for them to learn how to do because it seems like a way that you can grow some really high-quality, nutritious food for yourself.
Oh, it's a great way to, I mean, feed your family with high-quality high-quality produce, right? Because it's, you know, it's so easy. I mean, I keep them going consistently just because I like to have them as the base of a salad. Sunflower, peas, radish. Radish are nice and spicy. Spice up a salad. It looks pretty. Everybody likes it. And it's as simple as, you know, broadcasting some seeds once a week and watering them and harvesting. It's.
See, you've got me ready to do this, not just for myself, but so I got these people coming here for eggs.
Yeah.
Well, it would be real easy to just say, you know, here's a small sampling of microgreens. Because we're developing customers that come every week, every 2 weeks, what have you. And I don't see myself having time to run around or my wife having time to run around to restaurants and run things that way. But on one hand, it seems like it can be the way that you create a customer base. But it also seems like, on the other hand, it's something you could plug into a customer base. Because I feel like if I gave the type of customer that drives 45 minutes to buy 2 dozen duck eggs, right? If I gave them a clamshell of like a really great mix of microgreens and said, go home and use this as a salad or put this on your salad or put this on top of your soup or whatever tonight, that person's going to come back and they're not going to even think twice about spending $6, $7, $8 for a clamshell of that every couple weeks because they're already the person that's predisposed to drive 45 minutes to buy a couple dozen duck eggs.
Exactly. Exactly. And the best part is, right, if you're growing it for yourself, you got extra, you can feed it to the chickens. I think the ducks would eat it too. I'm not sure.
Tear the shit out of it. I mean, to be honest with you, that's like, you know, that would be like duck crack.
Right, exactly. Exactly. A friend of mine was always trading me eggs for like the microgreens I didn't sell because, you know, her chickens would just go crazy for it. So, yeah, I mean, and I love where your head's at with, okay, I've got these customers. I'm already selling them eggs. Like, what else can I help them out with? They're already making the trek out here. Let's, you know, because the thing with microgreens is that they really don't take a lot of time to produce. The challenge is that you just got to water them every day.
Yeah, that's what I was going to get to, right? Because, you know, when I garden, I focus on perennials, deep mulches, living soils, and deep root systems. It's hard to do with the rock, but that's what I do. And if I do that, my irrigation requirements go way, way down. Okay, let's face it. The plant in its first 14 days, it ain't going to have a deep root system. And if I put it in a little plastic tray, that's not ever going to happen. So it's like a baby. It's exactly what it is. It's dependent upon me. So, you know, taking a couple days off, and you know, not that it takes a lot of time per day, I would imagine, but if I want to leave for a couple days, it's one more thing that somebody has to do. So did you ever come up with a way to automate this?
You know, I didn't. The way to do it, if you really are keen about it, is to set up a hydroponic system. The challenge I have with a hydroponic system is that you're using synthetic fertilizers,
yep,
which I'm not totally keen on. But in terms of automating it, it's the way to go because you don't have to water it every day.
Will
every...
you ever get the flavor, though, of something soil grown? I mean, that would be my other concern.
Well, you know, they say in terms of flavor, right, the
it's such the a young plant. It's probably less dependent on, like, you know, those interactions.
It takes the nutrients, the micro and macronutrients from the soil. So
yeah.
What it does, though, is it just takes the nutrients. So if you were to create that concoction of nutrients in your water with the hydroponic system, you know, you could conceivably get that same flavor because it is, but it's something to just test.
It seems like I got to get Evan Folds on here from Progressive Gardens and talk about, can we brew a tea specifically for this?
There you go.
Right, that would be cool. So my other question then, though, is, so my tray's done, right? And I'm going to harvest.
Yeah.
So there's probably a way that I do that so I don't jack everything up and ruin it. And then when I'm done, I've got this tray full of roots. Do I dump that? Do I just seed on top of it? How do I go to the next cycle with that?
You know, I'll answer that composting thing real quick. Basically, you can, you harvested it and you've got this tray full of soil that's basically root bound. I mean, what you can do is you can lift up that whole block of soil in one hand, take it out of the tray, and it's all in, it's just one big block of soil because the roots have interwoven, seeking out water, and basically woven together one big soil mat. So there's no way you can use it again. So what you do, and what I did, is I just had two big logs. And this isn't what everybody's going to do, but just to illustrate what I did, it's, you know, two big logs about 2 feet in diameter and about 30 feet long parallel to one another. So basically two big borders of a garden bed and about 3 feet apart. And what I would do is I would take, you know, every week the 100 trays soil that's all knit together that I can't use anymore. And I just dump it in these logs, you know, in between these two logs. And then I had I had a relationship with a guy who had, who did like tree grinding or brush clearing. And so he always had mulch. Basically, he had as much mulch as I could ever handle. And every week or really every day, he would come by and dump mulch. And so I had a big pile of mulch. And so once it filled up, got to the 2-3 feet high, flush with the top of the logs, I would add mulch to it, and then that just became my garden bed. So I would fill it up, then add mulch to it, and then that's just what I planted. Like, I just had an annual veggie garden right next to the greens, just for myself. But, you know, within a year, that soil is just perfect and ready to go again. It's all full of earthworms, and so I could start filling my trays again with that soil. But it's so far in the future.
Yeah, yeah. I was just thinking, like, the other thing is people that own chickens, chickens would be all about that. All those little young roots, that just would be like chicken candy.
Oh, perfect.
So you could then kind of take Jeff Lawton's thing with the chicken tractor on steroids, whip 100, you know, mats of those things into a contained area, put chickens on it for a couple weeks to turn it, to tear it apart, to eat all the roots, to chicken poo on it. and then turn that to its own pile to compost, and you could accelerate that if somebody wanted to take it to that level. Your way was like low tech, simple, easy, and you got a garden, and then you got soil the next season. But it could be accelerated if somebody wanted to do it. That would be one way it could be accelerated.
Absolutely. Toss them down, let the chickens go to town. I mean,
because they would
as passive as possible.
Yeah, they would. It would be like throwing them. It'd just be like when you do a mat of fodder and you throw it out there and they all like attack each other over it. Because when you throw them fodder, they don't just eat the top. They eat the heck out of the roots. They actually seem to prefer the roots because the roots are denied the light and they're not that old and they're tender. And it's exactly really the same. When I do fodder, it's the same thing. I'm just doing it without soil. And
yeah.
And that's like the crack to the chicken. The geese are more about the green part because they're grass grazers, or the ducks are kind of, we'll take it all. But the chickens, that, you know, they're pulling the roots off the bottom from the fodder if you let it go long enough to be, you know, a few inches of grass. So there's a lot of things you could do with it. But I was just thinking, I didn't think you could plant into it again. It has
no, yeah, that's the big thing. You can't plant into it.
So your recurring expense is soil and seed.
Yeah, and honestly, seeds trump soil. To give you an idea, basically, you can get your soil cost low if you can find – usually you can find somebody who's got compost that'll sell it by the yard. If you can buy it anywhere south of $40 per yard, per cubic yard of soil, I mean, that's huge. You might spend 40 bucks every two
now
weeks or every
week.
You
can't use a pure compost media, can you? You have to mix something in with that.
You know, I would just get compost from the city.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it's
– Well, I mean, I could buy it for – $25 a yard with my military discount from the people up here. So I thought you would have to lighten it with something to make sure it would drain. But I guess since you're so rigorous about the watering, it's not as critical.
Well, yeah. So you water every day and it really just get good at watering. You get to the point where when you water every tray, if you have, because the trays have holes in them, if you have water coming out the bottom of the tray, it means you gave it too much water.
Mm.
Because you've got healthy soil, there's organic material in it that you just water it and it's basically acts like a sponge, soaks it up, and no water comes out the bottom, and the plants, you know, transpire the water out after over the day, and then you give them more water, and yeah, it's a pretty simple process.
Wow, that's good to know, because that was my concern, that if you're having to develop, you know, like a vermiculite or a perlite based draining soil, that's going to be a problem. So if you can go with a straight compost, then the dirt expense, the soil expense, does get minimized really quickly. You just need a good quality source of bulk compost, which, well, anywhere there's going to be a market for this, there's going to be that.
That's it. And I mean, beyond just dollar expense, time expense, my whole thing is, man, how do we do this as effectively as possible, as value our time as much as possible? And that's what's cool about the microgreens thing. Once you're up and running, you know, it takes about an hour, hour and a half to plant 100 trays out. But then the rest of the days that you're not harvesting or directly selling them, you're just watering. And that watering takes like 5 minutes every day, right?
Yeah.
It's just so simple. Well, so once you got your systems.
When you're doing the seed, right, you probably don't just grab a handful and throw it in there, right? So is there like, do you use like a shaker? Do you come up with your own thing? I guess it's different with different seeds. Sunflower seeds are obviously a lot bigger than something like a radish, which is bigger than something like a lettuce or a broccoli. So
yeah, absolutely. Good question. So let's see, where to start? Well, for one, sunflower and peas are basically the only two seeds that you're going to soak overnight. You're going to set aside however much seed you're going to use, and you're going to soak it you can do it in a 5-gallon bucket that you've cleaned. What I would do is put it in a mesh bag, but like kind of like a laundry bag. I made them out of screen material, sewed them up, and put your screen in there. They're soaking in the bags, and then when you're done, overnight, you pull them out of the bag, out of the water, put a spring clamp onto the bucket, drain the bucket. So now they're just sitting there draining all out of the mesh bag, and then they're ready to plant after you've soaked them. And what that soaking does for peas and sunflowers, just peas and sunflowers, is it basically increases the germination rate. If you don't soak them, you'll get crappy germination rate. If you do, you'll get, you know, close to 95% or more, like you should. Now, as far as how you scatter the seeds or you distribute the seeds, every seed is different sizes, obviously. So what you want to do is determine the weight or the volume of each seed. And I do it both ways, but I like to know both because I have like a little scooper, kind of like a scooper you might find in a protein bag or something that's got the handle and it's about like an inch or two deep and maybe an inch in diameter. And that's about right for a lot of them. And you just figure out what the optimal density per tray is. And then you say, okay, it's 1.5 scoops of radish. So you dip in, get a scoop of radish, spread it out. Doesn't have to go through a sifter or anything. You just kind of broadcast back and forth onto the soil. Then you get your half scoop and then you broadcast back on into the soil. And as a general rule of thumb, the right density, depending on the crop, is about one seed length apart from one another. So it's really dense. So if you were to have a tray fully covered with seeds, like every seed is touching and almost on top of one another, just about half to three quarters of that amount is the ideal density.
Okay.
And you know, what that is it's kind of got to use a scientific method once, you know, like just growing out, basically measuring like, okay, I'm going to put 1.5 grams of radish seed on this one. I'm going to put 1.75 grams of radish seed on this tray and then just measure the yield. And if they get too dense, they might start getting some like kind of rot issues because anytime you have, foliage that's touching other foliage and there's moisture, you know, between the two leaves, you're going to get rot. So again, that's why you want to have a really nice dry growing environment and keep air moving. Yeah.
Now you have a book about how to do all this stuff. You give a discount to my premium members. So if anybody's going to buy that, that's an MSB member, you should log in and get your discount code first because it's a big discount. But in the book, you talk about the business aspects a lot. Does the person learn all of the mechanical production aspects as well in that book?
Yeah, absolutely. You get all the details. I'm thinking more and more that I'm going to put together a specific list of, all right, radish is this many grams per tray. Peas are this many grams per tray. And if guys are interested in that, let me know. I'll put it together. But yeah, we go through all the details of exactly how to grow it, how to broadcast the seeds, A to Z of how to start the microgreens business.
Very cool. And for folks that want to learn more about what you're doing and get that book, where do they get that at?
Yeah. So if you're looking to connect with me and what I've got going on, check out localbusinessplans.com/TSP. And I've got some special resources for you listening here. And, yeah, basically what I'm doing with Local Business Plans is my mission is to help you get your local business started, whether it's microgreens or whether it's urban farming or permaculture landscaping or whatever it is. I'm bringing people together and providing you the resources to get going with that.
Well, I appreciate that. And I was looking at your site, and it looks like there's a lot of plans for that to grow. Like you started with this because you did this and you know this business and you made money in this business, frankly. You made more money doing this. You hustled for it. You worked your butt off for it. But you made better billing doing this than a lot of people do with, you know, white collar jobs because you made something out of it. So I think it was a great place to start. And I'm kind of excited to see where you go from here.
Yeah, thanks. Actually, what I'm really excited about is Curtis Stone and I, who's the urban farmer I kind of talked about earlier. He and I are going through and we've spent the entire last year filming every aspect of his urban farm business. And
that's a spin model, right?
Yeah, that's right. He's the guy who kind of championed spin, and now he's created his own method because, I mean, basically he's built it out to the point of this is every single step. This is the information he wishes he had 5 years ago when he started his urban farm. And so we've created a step-by-step course to take you through starting an urban farm. And, yeah, I'm really excited about that. And that's if you go to profitableurbanfarming.com. Again, I'll have the resource at localbusinessplans.com/TSP. And we're going to be launching that in about a couple weeks. We're just getting ready to publish, and I'm just going through with a fine-tooth comb on everything there. So, yeah, I'm really excited about that. And that's kind of the flavor of the other courses, the other education that we're releasing at localbusinessplans.com to give you a sense of things.
Very cool, man. Well, again, I'm excited to watch that develop over there, and I appreciate you being with us today on the show, Luke.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Jack. I really, really had a good time.
All right, folks, with that, it's been Jack Spirico today along with Luke Callahan, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough or even if they don't.
Seeing our food these days, you know it's on our TVs. Sometimes we forget we are what we eat. I don't know the answer. It's like there's nothing I can do. It's the price we pay, I guess, when we follow all the rules. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. Nobody up there cares.